This conference is giving us an opportunity to relive old experiences and try to cast them in the light of today's demands. And I hope that those of you who were too young to actually remember Malcolm or to have been active during the time that he was on the scene are giving thought to your own contributions to the onward advancement of African people and other people in the world who are oppressed. From Vicki's exposition and from Robert Cole's talk about writers in Ghana at the time of Malcolm's visit, you know that people were giving serious thought and that African Americans were well represented around the world. We tried to send, or those of us who were out traveling felt very consciously our need to represent our people as well as we could. And today we have the greatest debate on whether or not Two Live Crew should be able to vulgarize and have full freedom of speech to say nothing. I think this is a real good example of just about how low we have sunk in the world, that we go from in 25 years from having a Paul Robeson and a W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X at being the main speakers. And even on the cultural front, we had James Brown, who was Black and Proud, and we had other folk who meant something. And now we have artists who are painting their faces white, cutting off their noses, doing things to try to de-Africanize themselves, and we're becoming jokes around the world rather than people who are taken seriously as we were years ago. This conference, I think, for these reasons, is very valuable. And I will add just a few things to the discussion of Malcolm in Ghana, which is what this workshop focuses on. Having been there at the time was a tremendous thing for us. In my life, I still wake up and say, how was I smart enough to know that I needed to get out of the United States and to get out in 1962 when I left and go to Ghana? There was nowhere else to go if you were going to go to Africa. You really didn't think about anywhere else except Ghana for the reasons that Vicki explained. But those of us who went there are about the only Americans of African descent who've ever been free. We can talk about being free here, but we're not free, and there's no possibility that we will be free anytime soon. But we were free in Ghana because we were in a Black country that was moving forward and that we did not think was going to be stopped. Of course, I don't think we really fully understood the strength of imperialism and the various ways that people can be stopped from doing what appears to be in the cards for them. Vicki also gave you context, as did Robert Coles, for Malcolm's visit. He was not the lone internationalist. After all, we were there when he visited, and there were probably about 200 to 300 Afro-Americans living in Ghana at the time. But shortly before his visit, we had lost the great Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, and I have a few newspapers here just to show you the kind of treatment that Dr. Du Bois's death was given in Ghana. It was a major loss to the entire Black world, and it was portrayed as such. Du Bois, an African prophet. State burial for the great man. The Evening News, Osagyefo pays glowing tribute. We mourn Du Bois, a great son of Africa. That was how he was characterized. The Daily Graphic, fighter Du Bois dead at 96. On the night that he died, we demonstrated at the American Embassy to coincide with the Great March on Washington in 1963. Because of the time difference, we started our march at midnight so that we would be marching when the march was going on here. This picture at the bottom shows Dr. Alpheus Hunton with the consul general who was in charge of the embassy when we went in to present the petition against the U.S. brutality against African Americans. And then the second picture shows some of the picket signs we had. Dr. Du Bois actually died while people were assembling for that march. so that when we marched at midnight, we knew he was dead. It was just a few months after that that Malcolm came to Ghana. So we were ready for him. We had people in positions in Ghana, such as Julian Mayfield, who was part of the press corps, and Dr. Shirley Graham Du Bois, who is shown with Malcolm in the third picture and on that panel over there. Shirley Graham Du Bois was the one who was actually close enough to President Kwame Nkrumah to arrange for Malcolm to see Kwame Nkrumah. The rest of us did not have contact at quite that high level. So Shirley did that. Originally she was reluctant to do it because she had heard information about Malcolm being a firebrand and perhaps not the type of person that she would want to introduce to the president. But when she met him at one of the parties that was held for him, she was absolutely captivated, and he was equally captivated with her. If you look at the latest book that Pathfinder Press published, Malcolm X, The Last Speeches, I think it's on page 96, there is a passage where he gives a great deal of tribute and honor to Mrs. Du Bois as a very brilliant woman whose contributions to the struggle were very important. When Malcolm was killed, I was in Nairobi at the time, and someone came to the conference where I was working and told me that he had been murdered. And I got sick immediately, and I just had to leave. And it was quite some time after the autobiography of Malcolm X was published before I could actually read the book. I just emotionally couldn't deal with trying to read it. When I did, the passage on Ghana sounded familiar to me. And I said, some of this sounds like it came from a letter that I sent back to friends after Malcolm's visit. My goods were stored in Zambia at the time, the last country where I worked, and I didn't have the letter. So I wrote to Sister Christine Johnson in Chicago, who was one of the people I had sent it to and who I knew was well enough organized so she would dig it out. And she did, and she made a photocopy of it and sent it to me. And when I compared it with the chapter, I saw that most of the chapter is taken from the letter, either direct quotations or paraphrasing. There's no attribution, though, because it is handled as though it is Malcolm's autobiography, so the words are handled as though they were his. But they are, in fact, taken from the letter. And what I tried to do in the letter that I sent only to about a dozen people in the States and a few in Africa was to convey the significance of Malcolm's visit and just to describe everything that was done. And some of the material I knew would be difficult to have validated if somebody else who was on the scene didn't write and let people know, so that when Malcolm came and talked about the kind of reception that he had, people would not say he was exaggerating. And in fact, a New York woman, Ethel Jones, who was one of the recipients, told me about being at a meeting where Malcolm was present and reading the letter and then having Malcolm tell her that he was very appreciative because having my letter to say what he was saying validated his comments about his the visit that he had here. I'm going to read just a few portions of this so that you can get some idea of how excited we were and what the sweep of his visit was. I want to name the other people who were on the Malcolm X committee, in addition to Vicki Garvin, Maya Angelou, and Julian Mayfield. There was Julian's wife, Aunt Olivia, and Robert and Sarah Lee, two dentists who went to Ghana early in, perhaps even before independence. Sarah died last year in November. Bobby is still practicing dentistry in Accra. But I want to just put those names out into the ether. And I'll read just a real short part of this to talk about the whirlwind effect of this. Let me read the piece about Winnebah. After Malcolm spoke to the people at Parliament House, We left and took him to Winneba, 39 miles away, the training ground for the cadres needed to carry forward the revolution. All 200 students were present for Malcolm's lecture. As usual, he was brilliant, and he communicated with them at their own high level of political awareness. The one discordant note was struck during the question period when a young Afro-American, whom none of us knew, rose and prefaced his question with, quote, "I am an American Negro. The U.S. government did not send me here. They know I am here, but they have never talked to me about and therefore I am not qualified to discuss the American government's attitude toward Ghana the way you have done." At this point, the students began to boo and harass him, and Malcolm had to calm them down to hear his question, which was really a vague defense of American whiteism and revealed his feeling that Afro-Americans cannot really change the situation, so why should they abandon passive resistance and accommodation? The students were incensed, but the young man's question did give Malcolm the opportunity to illustrate his point about snake-bitten Afro-Americans. He had earlier told us that we shouldn't criticize a man who has been snake-bitten. You try to treat him for the snake bite, and he compared the average Afro-American who was very much involved in defending this country and its behavior with a person who had been snake-bitten. After the meeting, the students cornered this fellow, who turned out to be a teacher placed by the African American Institute in a local secondary school, and yelled, "Are you a victim of Rockefeller? Stop corrupting our children and come to this institute for some orientation." And they shouted other criticisms at him. He was rescued from his panic, because he was really surrounded by that time, by a fellow teacher who drove him away amid shouts of "Stooge, CIA, an American agent." At the close of the meeting, Malcolm was presented with a set of President Nkrumah's books and was given a tour of the school. Now, by Saturday, we were all nearly crazy with fatigue, but we were ashamed to make an issue of it, because the person who had expended the most energy, mentally and physically, was still going strong, was alert and responsive. He said he was tired too, but I really don't believe it. He attributed his stamina in part to the discipline of his religion. The rest of us were smoking excessively, and some were drinking heavily, so that we did get tired before he did. The Nigerian High Commissioner gave Malcolm the reception that demonstrated the solidarity that other Muslims felt with people in America who had adopted the religion. After a very good lunch, he gave Malcolm a very beautiful blue robe and an orange turban. And the High Commissioner, Alhaji Isawali, was about this high, maybe under 5 feet tall. So the picture of him with Malcolm was amusing, but he was very dignified and very serious. So when he wanted to tie Malcolm's turban, Malcolm had to bend down like this so that he could do it and reach Malcolm's head. And he also gave Malcolm a 2-volume set of the Quran. And he made statements about a book that showed a Nigerian Muslim, I think it must have been an illustration from some time back, a regal man, and also there was a picture of Malcolm in the same article. And Alhaji Isawali said, "When I looked at these photographs, I knew these two people were one. The only difference is that one was born in America and the other in Africa." And that was very meaningful for us, though most of us were not Muslims. I think probably none of the other Afro-Americans there was a Muslim, but still it was meaningful to us that there was this tie, which meant something and which had some real solidarity attached to it. Early Sunday morning, we met at the hotel to take Malcolm to the airport. We encountered the world's heavyweight champion returning from his morning walk. Muhammad Ali had arrived at noon on the previous day and had received a tumultuous welcome. We chatted for just a moment, then went to the airport. Others came too to say goodbye to Malcolm. We had coffee and returned and listened to all that he said. Underneath our light conversation, ran a current of concern for his safety upon his return to the United States. We talked to him about it. In fact, the somber expression on his face in that picture is because we were really telling him that we felt that the U.S. government would make an effort to kill him when he returned to the States, and he was quite serious. He was not prepared to be guided by any such fears. As a leader, this was his proper stand. His plane took off promptly at 9 a.m., and we watched until it was out of sight. As long as this letter is, I've only skimmed the surface of Malcolm's visit. Much more of great importance went on and is still going on, as you can well imagine. I hope, though, that I've included enough so that you will have an idea of the beautiful welcome he received and the effect he had on the community. I don't know what the American press will report or how much coverage will be given to his visit, but I have a feeling that they will try to minimize its importance or imply that he is exaggerating. That would be in keeping with the campaign to divide Africans and Afro-Americans. Some of you may not even get this letter if Uncle Sam's censors are overly alert. I'm sending out only a few copies to key people in several cities, and I hope that you will share it with other people, as did those of you who received my letter on the embassy demonstration and Dr. Du Bois' funeral last year. It's not for publication, but use it any other way you wish. We are in a battle, and since Malcolm is one of our most significant and militant leaders, efforts will be made to malign and discredit him. So many activists as possible should need all of the information that they can get. One extremely important fact is that Malcolm is the first Afro-American leader of national standing to take an independent trip to Africa since Dr. Du Bois came to Ghana. This may be the beginning of a new phase in our struggle. Let's make sure we don't give it less thought than the State Department is doubtless giving it right now. Malcolm spoke to us ceaselessly of unity. In his public speeches, in the small social gatherings, and the still smaller sessions that lasted until 2 or 3 nearly every morning, and at the airport just before he left. I cannot do justice to his exposition of this simple concept because the effect of it had on us is the result of hours of work on his part, forcing us to really grapple with the question. He had to wade through all of our questions, such as, but what do you do, how do you unify with Uncle Tom? How do you unify with people who may be FBI agents? How do you unify with people who really believe in passive resistance? And how do we, living in another country, unify with people who are actually working for the U.S. government and who rush out to save American flags? That referred to the incident when we demonstrated at the embassy, and when 6 o'clock came and it was time to take out the flag, all of the white people stayed in the embassy and sent out this one brother to take the flag down, and he came out, he was real proud too that they had given him this mission. He took down the flag. He actually was later decorated by Lyndon Johnson for having done that. And we were outside booing and hissing at him, but nobody tried to hurt him. But that was the source of the question of how do you unify with people who are actually working for the American government and who rush out to save American flags. Malcolm had no dogmatic answers, but he did give us some useful guides. The basis of his conviction is his belief that no black man can ever be so fully identified with the oppressive power structure that he is totally unamenable to change if he is properly helped to see his own interests. And even the card-carrying Uncle Tom may do you a quiet favor one day, give you some vital information, take a letter out of a file, open an important door for you, make it possible for you to get a point across on television or in a debate, as did the young man at Winneba. About passive resistors, he said, if a man is determined to go to Chicago, you can't stop him just by telling him that what he wants isn't in Chicago, even though you may know very well it's not there. He's got to try it his own way. So I'll get in the car and go all the way to Chicago with him. When he gets there and finds it's not there, then he'll ask me where I think it is, and we can go on from there. He believes that most of us can find some common ground with each other for action, although some are so corrupted by the system that they are not quite trustworthy. In the U.S., I can remember many of us used to demand that a person be willing to go all the way in terms of action, or we dismissed and condemned him rather than seeing if there was anything he could do for the cause. About the only people who escaped this rigidity were those with money, about whom we would say, well, he won't get out and do anything, but he will give some money on the QT. The United Front is particularly important in a struggle against a common enemy, because otherwise we waste much time and energy in factional disputes which masquerade as ideological disagreements and which only help the enemy. As Malcolm said, last year I was busy attacking King, and he was busy attacking the Muslims, and nobody was really attacking the devil. In the not yet liberated countries, that's the end of the quote, in the not yet liberated countries of Africa, we see the same inter-party fighting on a larger and more tragic scale, dissipating energy, retarding the liberation movement, and delighting the